We're going to move to the informational meeting, and we'll do some committee bills later as people arrive. But we will start with the informational testimony. And Dr. Cohen, would you come up, please? And okay. Mel, would you like to go ahead and get started?
Great. Well, thank you. Good afternoon. I am, for the record, I'm Dr. Mel Cohn, Chair Morissette, Senator Starr. I'm Dr. Mel Cohn. I'm a state epidemiologist at the Oregon Department of Human Services, and I'm going to be talking to you today about the obesity epidemic.
Good.
Can you give them the lights just a little bit?
Yes.
I'd like to just say that as a health policy committee, part of the purpose of establishing a committee on policy is to look at issues that will be dealt with in the future now, which doesn't preclude dealing with them this session, but we have to identify the problems and look for solutions and move into them now and in the future. So with that, we will let you go ahead and get started, Mel.
What I'm going to do this afternoon is try to give you some background on why this is such a big problem. First, describe the extent of the problem for you, and then give you some background on what might be causing this. And I think there are a lot of ideas about what might be done to try to address this problem. And some of those are ideas that might be appropriate for a legislature. Some of them are ideas that need to happen out in the community. But So, you know, I want to show you a series of maps here. This is obviously the United States. And the colors on these series of maps represent the percentage of adults in each state who identifies themselves as being what would be classified as obese. We just got started, so welcome. The colors, you can see the dark blue are states for which there's no data. The kind of pale green is less than 10% of adults identifying themselves as obese. The light blue, 10 to 14%, 15 to 19% dark blue, and 20% or more in red. As you notice, this is for 1990. So I want to show you what's happened with obesity in the United States over the last 10 years. So just watch. We're going year by year here.
Lord.
Now,
did I come down here to just get a sermon? Or?
This little state right here, fattest state on the West Coast, and the first to reach the 20% cutoff. So maybe I would end my presentation here.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
We put our loggers back to work instead of having to be lay around home.
Very good.
We'd probably
that out a little bit. Part of the solution.
So since 1980 in the United States, obesity has doubled among adults. It has doubled among children between the ages of 6 and 11 years old. And it has tripled among teens. And I'm going to talk in a little bit about the importance of what's happening in kids, because that's a particularly ominous development, I think, with regard to this problem. Currently, the toll is estimated to be about 300 deaths per year associated with obesity, and that makes obesity the second leading preventable cause of death, right behind tobacco, which is at about 400,000 deaths a year. The direct medical care costs in 2002 are estimated to be greater than $70 billion, and this accounts for somewhere between 5 and 10% of U.S. healthcare expenditures. So this is an enormous big-ticket item. Now, I just want to say a word or two about how we measure obesity, because you're going to hear me use some terms here, particularly this term body mass index, or BMI. The idea behind BMI is that somebody's weight you can't really interpret whether someone's overweight unless you also know how that weight compares to their height. I mean, somebody who weighs 120 pounds and is 5'4" would be looking. If that person weighs 200 pounds, that's something else entirely. On the other hand, somebody who's 6'3" and weighs 200 pounds, that might well be a normal weight for them. So you have to take both things into account. And this body mass index roughly corresponds with the amount of body fat that somebody has. So by measuring weight and height, you can have a sense of how much body fat somebody has. In adults, the World Health Organization classifies a BMI between 25 and 30 as overweight, greater than 30 as obese, and those maps I showed you are people who report their weight as greater than 30. And incidentally, those maps were all self-reported weights. And we know nobody ever lies about their weight, of course, but in case a few people did, if anything, they probably underestimated it. So those are, if anything, we're undercounting it.
Do you not have a comparison between the self-reporting and what the body mass would indicate? Is the real percentage in Oregon, for instance?
Or Senator Shields, no, actually, I don't have that data. But we do know, in general, that these things are substantially undercounted.
Yeah, among other things, we could find out how many of us are liars, you know. I mean.
We have BMIs that are greater than 40, and those are folks who would be classified as severely obese. In children, the situation is a little more complicated because the optimal BMI level for kids is age and sex specific. And so they're actually normed by percentile. If your BMI is over the 95th percentile, you're called overweight. We don't use the word obese in kids, although you may hear me slip into that a little bit in my talk here, because we don't want to label them and so forth. And then 85 to 94% would be considered at risk for overweight. So you can think of those two categories as roughly comparable to overweight and obese for adults. Now, I did give you a BMI table. It looks like this. So those of you in the audience, I think there are a few extras over there if you want to grab one after the presentation. And I just thought, in case you wanted to see where you stand in terms of BMI, I promise I won't ask. I promise I won't ask any of you to say it in public, but just for your own information, you have height on the left-hand side and then weight in pounds across the top. And you want to be in this gray zone right down the middle here.
It's gray. All right, get out the treadmill.
If I was a little taller, I'd be in great shape.
So here's what we know about obesity and overweight among Oregon adults. So these are those same BRFSS data, that same self-reported data, but these are the Oregon-specific ones. And you can see here, there's a little bit of a difference between men and women. Men, the red and orange here, these are obese and overweight, respectively. Men have more obesity and overweight than women do. Nonetheless, overall, almost 60% of Oregon adults are either overweight or obese using this classification. So this is a very big problem, even here in Oregon.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Minnis.
It's kind of interesting statistic, given Oregon is also one of the hungriest states in the nation. So I don't know how you reconcile that.
Chair Morissette, Senator Minnis, that is an interesting issue, and let me come back to that, if I may, because when we start talking about what some of the causes are here, if I don't mention it, please remind me again, and I'll give you my two cents on that. Okay. Now, the situation in youth, here we have 8th and 11th graders, again, divided into males and females, looks a little bit better. But even so, a substantial proportion here, I mean, if you put the overweight and at risk of overweight categories together here again, you're somewhere between 60 and 70% of kids are having normal weight. So, you know, somewhere between 30 and 40% of our youth are overweight. So this is a very big problem. Now, it's not just a cosmetic problem. I mean, I think up until now, that's the way folks thought about this. Well, I want to look nice in my bathing suit or in my my clothes. But in fact, it is an enormous health problem. We have an epidemic of diabetes that is going along with this. There's really two kinds of diabetes. They're called type 1 and type 2. Type 2 diabetes is the classical kind of diabetes where people inject insulin. It often occurs in young people. Type 2 diabetes used to be called adult onset diabetes. And the reason for this was that it occurred primarily in adults. What we're seeing now is not only are the numbers of adults with type 2 diabetes, this is a very obesity-related disease, are those numbers increasing dramatically, but also in children, those numbers are increasing dramatically. Of course, obesity also contributes to heart disease, stroke, joint problems, sleep apnea. There are a number of other issues related to nutritional intake, for example, cancer. There's some association between certain factors in the diet and cancer. And all of this together suggests that we are losing ground in terms of the wonderful progress we've made in preventing a lot of these diseases. But obesity is pushing us back in the other direction. There are enormous psychosocial consequences, particularly for youth. There's a lot of stigma associated with being overweight. We think of fat people as lazy, unhygienic, unsuccessful in school, and so forth. And for adolescents, this kind of blow to their self-esteem can be very, very devastating, lead to a variety of high-risk behaviors, unsafe sexual activity, drug and alcohol use, other kinds of juvenile delinquent activities, and so forth. Now, one of the things that's so concerning about this in kids, though, is that when you're obese as a child, you tend to be obese as an adult. In fact, 70 to 80% of obese teens become obese adults. So this incredible increase in obesity in teens, remember I said it doubled in age 6 to 11 years old since 1980 and tripled in teens. That incredible increase is really going to have a lot of impact down the road when these folks get older and become obese adults. Many of these health problems that are up here are diseases that take a long time to develop, and so when these folks are adults, they're going to have to start dealing with this. The flip side of that, of course, is that if we do something about this now and get these kids to lose weight, then we can prevent many of these diseases. For example, type 2 diabetes is, for the most part, completely reversible, at least in its early stages, if folks lose weight. I do want to say a word or two about the severely obese. These are those with a BMI greater than 40. And the number of severely obese has doubled in the last 10 years. I heard an estimate from the Centers for Disease Control that 5% of U.S. adults have a BMI greater than 40. These folks are very, very overweight. In a woman who is 5'4", this is about 100 pounds overweight. And African-American women appear to be particularly at risk. About 15% of women in that group have a BMI greater than 40. Now, these folks are candidates for the most severe kind of treatment that is available for this, and that is gastric bypass surgery. Again, big-ticket item, something that has a lot of other complications and so forth, not something you want to do if you can avoid it. I did mention before that childhood obesity tends to persist into adulthood, but with respect to severe obesity, not only are these kids obese as adults, they tend to be more obese than their counterparts who are not obese as teens, and they have about 4.9 BMI units more on average than adults, as adults rather. And this is in part what's driving this so severe obesity sub-epidemic here. Okay, so what's driving all of this? Well, really weight gain is the result of an imbalance between how many calories you take in, meaning how much you eat, and how many calories you expend, which is how physically active you are. You know, that's, you see my crude scale up here, it's a very simple balance. The problem is that very small changes in either food intake or activity can really dramatically affect how much weight you put on. And let me illustrate this by saying that if you eat 120 calories a day, not very much, 120 extra calories a day, that's 12 potato chips, okay? One Reese's peanut butter cup a day, and you don't change your physical activity level at all, you will put on about a pound of body fat in a month. And if you do that for a year, that's 12 pounds you've just gained in a year. So I think you can see how insidious this can kind of be. A tiny little change like that, just a few extra potato chips, can easily put on a lot of weight over time. And I think that that is a lot of what's happened with this epidemic, are a lot of small changes that have led us to where we are today. Now, the Surgeon General recommends that we have a lot of physical activity. He says 30 minutes a day, 30 minutes of moderate physical activity most, if not all, days. There's a couple of things I want to emphasize here. First of all, this word moderate over here. This is not people becoming Olympic athletes. This is people just incorporating regular kinds of activities into their day. Taking a walk, gardening, riding a bike, and so forth. Second of all, this most, if not all, days, this really needs to be something that people do all the time. It's a part of their daily routine. And so that's really where we want to be headed if we want to address this issue of physical activity. But how are we doing here in Oregon with regard to physical activity? These are, again, from our self-report survey, and we asked Oregonians how much moderate physical activity they do. This graph shows the blue is men and the pink is for women, and across the bottom here are different age groups. And this is the percentage of adult Oregonians who report having at least 30 minutes of moderate physical activity 5 or more days a week. And you can see there's a little bit of variation by age and gender, but more or less we're somewhere around 40% here. So we've got a long way to go to meet even what's the minimum recommended by the Surgeon General. And the situation with our youth is a little bit better. Here again, blue and pink for males and females. We have 8th and 11th graders. And you can see that, you know, somewhere around 70% or so report being physically active. But look at this drop-off here, particularly among girls. Here we're down to about 40%, which is what we see in adults. So these are critical years for kids to be developing the kinds of habits around regular daily physical activity. And this is a very important thing to remember as we think about what we might do to address this problem. Now let's look at the other side of the equation. That's the healthy eating side. It boils down to how many calories you're taking in. There's a lot of controversy about this, and probably many of you are familiar with this. I certainly hear it from my friends, I imagine you do as well, about how important it is to take in carbohydrates versus fat and protein. We have the Atkins diet out there. That's a high-fat, high-protein diet versus carbs. There are a lot of issues around cholesterol. What's the good kind of fat, the bad kind of fat? So I'm not really going to talk about those controversies today. I just want to acknowledge them. What I think we do have consensus about is the importance of having 5-a-day portions of fruits and vegetables. And that's in quotes because that's the U.S. Department of Agriculture's program for promoting fruit and vegetable intake. Eating that amount of fruit and vegetables a day does a lot of good things. It gives you fiber, gives you antioxidants. And with regard to this particular problem of obesity, vegetables are low in calorie, but they're kind of bulky, so they fill you up. So they're a very good thing to eat. And if we could increase the amount of people who eat 5 a day, we probably would make some dent in this obesity epidemic. So how are we doing in Oregon? Well, unfortunately, pretty dismally. This, again, shows the percentage of adult Oregonians, men and women. And you can see men, only about 25% report eating 5 a day. And women were up to about 30%, but still not doing very well. And for our youth, we're essentially in the same ballpark. So we've got a long way to go on both of these critical factors for reducing obesity. So why do we have an epidemic of this now? Well, we often think about eating as really an individual issue. And ultimately, I suppose it is, you know, how much that individual takes and puts in their mouth or how much they choose to exercise. But, you know, we've seen this enormous change over the last 10 years, actually over the last 20 years. So what's changed? I mean, people haven't suddenly become lazy or gluttonous. We've had those problems since time immemorial. I think what really has changed is our environment. And it's our environment that constrains and supports the kind of decisions we make about eating and physical activity. Really what's happened is that many of the opportunities for physical activity and healthy eating that we have been engineered right out of our lives. It's been a slow and, each little step in and of itself may be inconsequential, but when you add them all up, I think that's really how we've gotten to where we are today with obesity. So if that's what the problem is, then what do we do to change that? Well, we really want to change the environment, and I use that word environment in a loose way to include not only the physical environment, but the social environment and so forth, to change those environments to support us in making healthy choices. We have some experience with this with tobacco, where we had a similarly intractable problem and have made tremendous inroads by using a comprehensive approach. And the idea here is that you need to hear multiple cues and messages in the environment to support you making the healthy choices. For example, you're a smoker. You go to your doctor says, you know, you should really quit smoking. Well, you may or may not take his or her advice in that, but when you hear it from your wife, and when you hear it from your friends, and when you can't smoke in your workplace, so you have to actually do something to smoke, get up out of your chair and go outside, when it costs a lot of your extra expendable income to continue smoking and so forth, well, then maybe you begin to take this idea of quitting more seriously. And that's the kind of thing, this focus on the environment, that we really need to address this obesity issue. So what are some of the changes we've seen in the food environment? Well, we now have a lot more availability of high-calorie foods. We've got vending machines everywhere. People are increasingly eating outside the home. There's a lot of fast food available, which tends to be very high in calorie. And all of this has also displaced our eating of fruits and vegetables, because after all, if you're eating a Twinkie, you're not eating an apple, right? Supersized portions, lots of advertising and marketing around that, and really a lot of marketing focused on increasing food consumption. Now, I'm not calling any of these things evil or pointing the finger at any of these things as, you know, intrinsically bad, but the net effect of all of this is to increase our food intake, these changes in our environment. Similarly, in our physical environment, in our environment with regard to physical activity, a lot of us have office jobs where instead of cutting timber, as Senator Fisher said before, we're sitting at our desk. We have more and more elevators around, so we're not using the stairs. Our kids have less and less physical education in schools, more and more TV and computer use. We drive everywhere. And our land use patterns feed into this kind of lack of physical activity. So the key here is to make the healthy choice the easy choice for people. And when you do that, people will make those healthy choices. Okay, so now I want to talk a little bit about what we might do, some ideas that folks have postulated, and what kinds of data we have about what might work. And I'm going to kind of organize this by setting. So we've got medical settings, schools, work sites, and communities. In the medical setting, there's no doubt that doctors are very influential with their patients, and just talking about them, I mean, we know this for tobacco, for example, that's a very, very important factor in people's decision to quit smoking. So doctors need to counsel patients about this. But there are some barriers to that. They don't get reimbursed for counseling patients about being overweight in general. They're pressed for time. Often they don't have the knowledge about what a big issue this is, so there's some professional education that needs to be done. And then there's the self-efficacy issue, the sense that doctors might have that, well, I don't really know what to do if I discover that somebody's overweight. What really can I do for them? So some of the ideas to address some of this, for one thing, make it easy to measure BMI. I gave you that little table. If you have to sit down and calculate that for every patient who comes in your office, you know, that's an extra minute or two that you could be spending doing something else. Then once you've given a patient a BMI, to link that to some prompts so that if a patient is obese, you know, you're somehow prompted to talk to them about what they might do in their lives to change that situation. Getting non-physicians involved in the office. This doesn't all have to be delivered by a doctor. So, you know, identifying that the patient has a problem with weight and then having somebody else in the office who can help counsel them might be a very efficient way to do it. And then linking it to community supports. It doesn't make any sense to tell people they should go out and ride a bike if there's no place to ride a bike in their community. Now, how about in schools? I mentioned physical education. You know, the schools are under tremendous financial pressure. We all know that. And PE is one of the first things that often gets cut. And I think that is really a contributing factor here to this epidemic. Walking to school. Now, how many of you walk to school as kids?
Sometimes.
Almost everyone. If I asked you how many of your kids walk to school, I bet the number would be far fewer. And we just, our communities are not designed that way. We're concerned about safety and so forth. Getting kids to walk to school, that's another daily activity that kids could be doing to get some physical activity. Competitive foods. This is the idea that what the foods that kids have available to them in a vending machine at school, again, they're displacing healthier choices that they might make. Pouring contracts. Some schools have contracts that require that they only have a certain kind of beverage available, and it's the one that whoever is paying them through this contract wants sold. Well, if those beverages are things that are high in calorie, like a lot of pop is, for example, that's a problem that's contributing to this as well. And finally, comprehensive interventions in school. None of these individual things is going to completely turn the tide. We really need to address this in as many ways as possible, looking at the school kind of as a little mini environment, if you will, where this comprehensive approach is what's going to make the difference. In work sites, having some break time to encourage physical activity. You all are going to hear from Nike in a little bit. And Molly, I hope you will talk about that a little bit, the program that Nike has about allowing people to be physically active during the day. Having a place to exercise in your office building or in your neighborhood, in the neighborhood of the office building. Having healthy food choices in the company cafeteria. Having prompts to use the stairs. I want to come back to this. And I think that the increasing health costs associated with this obesity epidemic really can be a very motivating factor for employers to undertake some of these changes.
So, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Dr. Cohn, I use the stairs in this building almost consistently, and so I'm guessing that you might like to put a little note up on all the elevators. Remember the stairs, so that we won't gain the 10 or 15 pounds we gain each session.
Chair Morissette, Senator Walker, absolutely. And this is an experiment about that. Let me tell you about this. This slide is from the Centers for Disease Control. Okay, and these are the stairways in their building, and you can see it says before. They don't look like very attractive places. They're gray. They're dark. So they decided, well, let's do something like this. Okay, let's make them more attractive places for people to walk. So this is what they did.
Oh, wow.
When I saw this, I had a little twinge of pride. I wondered if that was Mount Hood, actually.
There's no halo over it.
So they put up all these beautiful pictures, and guess what happened?
Use the stairs.
Absolutely nothing.
What?
Nobody used the stairs.
Oh, man.
So they said, well, wait a minute. Maybe we need to do something else. And they took your idea. They put a sign up that said, remember, the stairs are here. Please use the stairs. And all of a sudden, people started using the stairs. They had actually about an 8% increase in stair usage. They actually tracked their employees doing this. Now, that increase, however, was transient. I mean, it only lasted about 3 months. And I think what happened is that this little notice kind of became part of the wallpaper after a while. It was novel at first, and people noticed it. So they tried a few other things. They put music in the stairwell, which I'm told they did very inexpensively, as they did here. And that had a much longer effect in terms of encouraging people. They had another 8% increase with music in the stairwell. From this, they learned that even something as simple as a prompt like that, at the point where you're making that decision, do I take the stairs or the elevator, can be a very powerful motivator. And it's not an expensive thing to do at all.
You know, Mr. Chair?
Before you speak again, I would ask you to take that on as part of this committee assignment. Would you please put signs up, personally do that, and make sure people know?
Yeah, but be careful.
Perhaps we could draft a rule.
Draft a rule.
Well, I was thinking that when you said that it became part of the wallpaper, you're right. I have sticky notes all over my wall, and pretty soon I forget them. But, you know, you could put a little saying, something new, on it once a week, and so, or one, or who has time once a day, but some new things so that people were going to read it because there's some new interesting factoid that they'll read and maybe they'll go up the stairs. And then you can learn another factoid when you go in the stairwell.
Factoid?
Yeah, a little factoid.
And I walk away when the session's over, I'd like to hire you as our coordinator for the
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. I'd love to do it.
Good, good. Thank you.
Okay, so
yeah,
this is,
signed up.
Again, you know, not expensive, but powerful in a small way.
Stairwell committee.
Now, in communities, there are similar issues, and it's quite interesting the way all of this kind of intersects with this land use planning and all of this community planning work that we do. First of all, what kinds of availability do we have for foods? Can people buy fruits and vegetables? Are there safe, attractive places to be physically active? A big issue in many communities. I think also in terms of communities, there are a lot of issues around communications. I think we need to make the case here that what we're doing is not taking people's choices away, not removing those choices. We're actually creating choices. I mean, when you go to the vending machine and there's nothing there but high-fat, high-calorie stuff, what choice do you have? On the other hand, if there's the high-fat, high-calorie stuff and some healthy stuff, at least you can make a choice. So we don't want to sort of be the food police or the physical activity police here, but we really want people to be able to make the healthy choice, the easy choice. I want to show you just a couple of examples. This is obviously not Portland, Oregon. You can tell by the palm trees here. I think this is from northern Florida. But, you know, when I look at this street, I mean, I want to walk into that picture and stroll down that road. There's a beautiful sidewalk. It's clear where I can walk. There's shade. There's interesting things to look at. I'm wondering, who's that lady riding the bicycle? You know, all of this kind of stuff about how you build a community really has an impact on how likely you are to take a walk. On the other hand, were none of that there, I would be, you know, I don't want to go there. I'm going to get in my air-conditioned car and go somewhere else. Now, this is also not Oregon. I'm not sure where this is from, but this could be Oregon. I mean, we certainly have communities that are built in this kind of design. And just assume for a minute that in this house over here lives a little girl named Vicky, and she wants to go visit her friend Marjorie, who happens to live over here. Okay. Now, in a normal way to go, Vicky would just, you know, walk right over here. She had a little bit of trouble here because there's a fence, right? And, you know, somehow get over here. But the way this is designed, that's impossible to do. So instead, Vicky has to say, Mom, will you give me a ride over to Marjorie's house? And they get in their car, and they go all the way here, and they go out here, and back up here. So, again, how this community was designed has made it very difficult for somebody to just get out and walk, to do the things that they do every day. It doesn't have to be this way. I mean, this is a choice that somebody made when they planned this community. Okay, so what are we doing about this here in Oregon? I should tell you, I'm not here to ask you for money.
Thank you.
I know that this is, you know, fiscally a very difficult time for all of us. But I do want to tell you what we're trying to do. In public health, this is a new area for us. We're really just beginning to address it. And we've managed to squeeze out through several federally funded projects the equivalent of about one FTE at the state level to work on this. And I want to introduce Dr. Jane Moore, who's sitting right here, who's the manager of our chronic disease program at the State Health Department. And she has really been instrumental in doing this and been a tireless advocate on this issue. Multnomah County also has a part-time FTE working on this. They're doing some very interesting things, including something called a walking school bus as a way to promote kids to walk to school. The idea is, instead of getting on a physical bus, they get together with a group of other kids. Actually, they're pulling in seniors as volunteers. So the seniors are meeting these kids. The seniors are getting out and exercising as well. And just taking these kids to school. It's safe. The kids learn good pedestrian skills, build social capital and community interaction, all kinds of good things. Not a terribly expensive program, nonetheless, although requires some oomph to kind of get it off the ground. That's one of the things that they have been working on. I'm not aware that any other county health department at this point is doing anything actively on this, although everybody's very interested in this. And we really are looking for opportunities to enhance and expand our program. A lot of this is going to be grant writing and so forth, and educate the public about this issue. because our staff is so limited, we spend a lot of time doing what we would call leadership activities and coalition building. And in just a minute or two, I'm going to ask Dr. Minot Cleveland to come, sitting right over here, who's been very involved in a lot of those coalition building activities, and also Molly White from Nike, to tell you about all of the many partners we've been able to pull into this. And I can tell you, the response has been absolutely incredible. I gave a talk about this at the City Club a couple of weeks ago, and I cannot believe the amount of email and phone calls I have gotten about this from people who, you know, kind of have the same reaction as you, Senator Walker, wanting to, you know, go ahead and do something, even something small, in their own community. It's really, it's got incredible appeal and attraction for people, this issue. Just 2 days ago, we launched our state plans, and Dr. Cleveland's going to tell you some more about those, for nutrition and physical activity to address these problems. And we had an incredible turnout at our launch event. Excuse me. We had planned for between 100 and 200 people. We had 269 register. We capped the registration there. I think we probably would have had over 300 had we been able to accommodate them. And really, this is a long-term commitment. I mean, none of this is going to happen overnight. This is going to take many years of work in a variety of ways. Okay. Now,
could we just wait for a second? Now, we want to do a quick work session while we have people here.
Okay.
And then we'll continue with this. So we have introduction of committee bills. Did you want to run through them?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we do have four LC drafts to introduce as committee bills, LC 993, 1468, 1472, and 2519. LC 993 has to do with AIDS, HIV. The other three are on behalf of the Governor's Task Force on the Future of Services to Seniors and People with Disabilities. To be honest, I'm not quite sure what all of these do, seeing that I picked them up this morning.
Okay.
I don't have one of them.
The three drafts from the task force, the governor's task force, I served on that committee. Representative Carlson, Senator Carno served on that committee, and Senator Brown. And these bills are to deal with some of the future policy that we hope someday to look at. We're gathering information for the most part, and so I would ask for some concurrence in terms of getting the bills introduced, and then they will be assigned to either this committee or another committee, and we'll go from there. Do we,
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm waiting for the Vice Chair to see whether he would make the motion or not.
You're welcome to go ahead if you wish.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I would move the introduction of LC 993, 1468, 1472, and 2519 as committee bills.
Okay. Senator Minnis has moved the introduction of LC 993, 1468, 1472, and 2519 as committee bills. Is there any discussion?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
There's a couple of them here that I am not willing to support, but there's probably enough votes in the committee to get them through. But I have made a pretty strong stand on bills that are mandates and that type of thing, and I'm continuing to follow that policy that I've had in times past. If the groups can get together and they bring us something and they say we can do this, that's one thing, but just to start getting a bunch of mandates turned loose, I'm not too sure that I'm going to change my policy on that.
Okay.
And also, as far as requiring pilot projects and stuff like this, and training or long-term care and retirement planning for Oregon residents, I think some of these things are a private thing, and they're not something that we need to be spending agency money on and getting a lot of staff and that type of thing geared up to at a time like this when we're facing the budget shortages that we are. So that's my own personal feeling, but
Okay. Other comments?
Just to my motion.
Pardon me?
Just to my motion.
Yes, to the motion.
Just, I don't disagree with Senator Fisher. In fact, when I consent to introduce committee bills, I never want that to be construed as support for the actual measure.
I understand. Okay. Would you go ahead and call the roll then, please?
Senator Minnis?
Aye.
Senator Shields? Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye.
Senator Morissette?
Aye. Okay. Thank you. The bills are introduced as committee bills. Now, let's go back and continue this very interesting, profitable discussion. Oh, okay. Okay. Well, we'll talk about the subcommittee that
hunger and obesity.
Senator Walker is chairing for the stairway.
The stairwell committee.
The stairwell committee, right?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I do. I think this is a very profitable discussion, and actually, it's one of the topics that I think is very appropriate for this particular committee. The question I'll ask those persons who are very familiar with these topics is to help us understand how, as a legislature, we can incent some of these programs. An example, I served 26 years with the Portland Police Bureau, and although we have weight training programs and exercise facilities in all of the precincts, we have never had a specific requirement for physical fitness beyond the initial introduction to the agency. You had to pass a specific physical fitness program, but beyond that, you could be as big or out of shape as you saw fit. The agency didn't do anything about it. It's that kind of crossing over in terms of what we know, developing public policy, and what I see as a potential financial benefit to public agencies in particular, where if we have public employees who are attuned to these kind of programs, I think it reduces our overall health costs and makes for healthier employees, too. So.
Senator Morissette, Senator Minnis, I absolutely agree with you. And I do have a couple of ideas at the end of my presentation along those lines, but would love to talk about that some more with you and other members of the committee.
Okay, thank you.
All we have to do is...
welcome.
Thank you, Chairman Morissette. I very much appreciate representing Nike and having a chance to talk to all of you kind of about an issue that's very important to the company. And
Could you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. For the record, my name is Molly White, and I'm Director of U.S. Community Affairs for Nike.
Okay.
And I did hand hard copies of the presentation, as well as a speech that our President of U.S. Region, Gary DiStefano, gave in partnership with Dr. Cohn at the City Club a couple of weeks ago. It's just background information. I will caveat this presentation by admitting that this is the first time I've presented to a Senate committee, so if I step on protocol, I will apologize up front. You can correct me. Nike is a 38-year-old Oregon-based company, and I have to say, of all the companies I've worked with, this is the most passionately locally-based global company I have ever seen. When you talk to people, particularly at the headquarters function in Beaverton, people are very passionately Oregonians, and they feel very strongly about being an Oregon-based company. And I think you probably all know Phil Knight, our chairman and CEO, is a very passionate Oregonian and duck. About a year ago, we completely rewrote our mission statement, our corporate mission statement, and our maxims, our sort of guiding policies, to move from and to broaden the mission from simply being about being the leading sports and fitness company in the world to being a company that inspired and supported the physical activity and sports participation of every body. And the revised mission statement actually reads, to provide inspiration and innovation to every athlete in the world. And the caveat to that mission statement is, if you have a body, you are an athlete. And this kind of revitalized mission really gave us a more re-energized commitment to the communities where we live and work. About the same time that we did that, we started looking at the intersection of what we have as company expertise and issues in the communities where we operate that are really compelling and that make sense for what we have to offer as a business. And as a sports and fitness company, we became extremely concerned with this growing epidemic of overweight and inactivity among youth. And I don't even need to speak to kind of the long and short-term implications of this, because Dr. Cohen has done a fabulous job. But suffice to say, Nike is extremely concerned with the ramifications, both to the population in Oregon, to the circumstances and future prospects for youth in the state of Oregon, and for businesses in Oregon. So we took a look at some of these statistics and some of the issues around these very sedentary kids and their problematic diets. And we put together a list of what we think we have to offer as Nike. And we came up with a list of things. First of all, Nike as a brand has a particularly compelling opportunity to inspire and empower kids. We have an ability as a brand to talk to kids and youth in a way that not too many agencies, organizations, businesses, parents do in some cases. We can inspire adults through the same brand communications and brand strengths that I just alluded to. We can engage our athletes. We have an unbelievable number of athletes, and many of those are top-tier marquee athletes that carry a tremendous amount of weight and inspirational appeal to youth and adults alike. When they talk, people tend to listen to them. We can use our products and engage our products, and obviously this is an area where physical inactivity and inspiring kids to get more active has an obvious intersection. And we can galvanize our employees in the car of the brand. And when I say galvanize employees, what we hope to do is bring all the employees that are based in Oregon in on this issue by inspiring safe routes to school programs and having those employees help run them as volunteers in the mornings by getting the walking school bus program going in their neighborhoods and so forth. So what we're trying to do is take an issue that we feel is particularly compelling and bring all the resources we have to bear as a company to work on it. And what we've launched is a program we're calling Nike Go. This is meant to be a long-term legacy program for the Nike brand across the U.S. with particular focus in Oregon. The mission of this program is to get kids moving and give them the means to do it. And the specifics are we're focusing particularly, at least in the short term, on 8 to 15-year-olds. The notion here, and I think you saw this in the data that Dr. Cohen presented, is that kids both are motivated to be active when they're in their younger elementary school years, and there are more programs in place, particularly PE, although we're seeing that fall off, for kids at that age group. Where you really start to see the declines in youth activity is when they start to move into the 8 to 15-year-old range, middle school, and then certainly high school. So we wanted to start at least begin the program by moving programs into that particular area of their life cycle to help boost that activity level back up. A tenet of the program is that it's by kids for kids, which means that we're not going to be Nike going in and saying, whatever the program partner is, we want kids to play more basketball, we want kids to be more active in volleyball. We want kids to come to us and tell us what is going to be a motivating kind of a program or activity that's going to get them and their peers involved. And we think this is pretty critical because kids have too many sexy, appealing, seductive alternatives to going outside or staying inside and being active. Kids are spending 5.5 hours a day, every day on average, in front of a TV or a computer. And if you factor in food time, bedtime, and school time, you've pretty much obliterated any alternatives that might include physical activity. In order to get kids away from those incredibly easy and appealing alternatives and into a physical activity, it's got to be driven by kids. And it's got to have peer participation, because if their peers are doing it, they're more likely to do it. It's got to be measurable, and we actually have brought in a professor from Morehead State in Kentucky who does a lot of evaluation for the CDC to do fall, winter, and spring evaluation on the Nike Go program to let us know whether we're getting the kinds of participation from these kids and, over the long term, some shifts in self-identity so that they start to think of themselves as active kids and hopefully long-term behavior and lifestyle shifts in these kids. So what we're really shooting for with Nike Go is long-term behavior and lifestyle shifts in the kids that participate in these programs that will extend into adulthood. The way that this program actually plays out is this year, as our first pilot year, we actually have 31 pilot grants in boys and girls clubs across the U.S., three of those in the city of Portland, our backyard. Again, built on the same sort of tenets that you see up there. And we're having those evaluated, as I said, fall, winter, and spring. what we hope to do starting in June, phase two, year two of the Nike Go program, is start to roll in an in-school component to see if there's a way, working very locally with individual districts and individual schools, principals, and teachers, that we can support PE teachers who have either had their programs cut back or underfunded and who may need training and support to deliver the best possible PE program. One of the things we found working on the whole notion of PE today and the data that's been collected on PE is that for the average 30-minute PE class that's delivered right now, 3.5 minutes are actively moving. The other 26.5 minutes are standing in line, getting instructions, waiting on the side because you didn't make it over the high jump or whatever it is you're doing. So, I mean, it's a staggering statistic, like most of the statistics Dr. Cohn is putting up, but it's appalling. If we've only got 2 hours of PE a week as it is, or 2 days of PE, and there's only 3.5 minutes that's active in either one of those classes, then we pretty much missed the boat altogether. So we definitely want to support high-quality PE in all the places where we still have it. And then we want to see if there's a way to work with teachers in schools that do not have PE to put together some kind of a long-term training program with a PE in a box kind of program so that those teachers can continue to keep their kids active. And we know from data coming from the California Department of Education, from the CDC, and from some other places, that while it's not absolutely A to B, there's a clear causal connection between physically active, fit kids and better academic performance. So we're hoping to bring some of that data in, show teachers what a great benefit they can have in terms of more settled, attentive students and better academic performance if we bring some of these programs in, and then see if we can get some PE back into schools. So in-school pilot for next year, after-school broadening beyond the Boys and Girls Clubs to other partners that could include the CDC, could include Portland Park and Rec, could include a number of different partners, all of them locally based, to help build after-school and summer programs that are specific to the communities and the demographics and the needs of the kids in those communities. Okay.
I'd like to add just one thought about PE. Several years ago, we visited the Howard Street School, which was kind of an alternative school and has since become a charter school. And their PE consisted of dance. That was it, just dance. All of the kids in that school had dance sessions, which was, I thought, kind of interesting because they were all active at the same time doing these dance things. So that's, I just throw that out so you can make some dance shoes and have people be in. Oh, and I want to say one other thing. I really appreciate the fact what you're doing because I firmly believe that what changes society are the norms that are established into things that people think they ought to be doing, and I think that you're in a position to do that by using your prestige and your athletes and so on, and people will do it because they think, gee, this is the thing to do now. So I think that that's the most effective way of, well, other than requiring PE classes, I think what you're doing is extremely effective, so I congratulate you for it.
Well, thank you. I think it's carrot and stick. I mean, our suspicion at this point is it's carrot and stick. The carrot, obviously, is the Michael Jordan's and some of the more appealing athletes serving messages. And then the stick, I think, is the this is what happens when your children aren't physically active. These are the current rates of obesity in the state of Oregon. This is what you need to think about in terms of what your kid is doing every day and what they're not doing. So I think, you know, and I assume Dr. Cohn would agree with me, we're still trying to, and I find this from the CDC and everyone else that's working on this issue, it's sort of like the beginning of the whole tobacco campaign. We're trying to figure out what the best course is and how all of us as partners need to partner on this program to try to get to the lifestyle shifts that we're shooting for by the time I'm at retirement. So I think it's a long-term process. We know it's a long-term process, and we also know that we are one of a number of partners. And what we really want to understand is what are the resources that we have as a company, and how do we mesh those very tightly with the State Epidemiologist's Office, the CDC, the Boys and Girls Clubs, the YMCAs, the Portland Parks and Recs, and all those people, and all of the schools, so that we can help drive this in an effective way. So Nike Go, that's kind of what it looks like. Nike Go in Oregon right now, and this is just a smattering of what Nike's been up to in the backyard. You're probably aware of the Courts and Facilities program that we did in Portland last summer. We actually refurbished 95 courts in all 30 parks in the city of Portland, and that included every basketball court and a few tennis and other kinds of facilities as well. That was actually completed in 67 days, and They were all actually refurbished with a pretty world-class surface called Nike Regrind, where we bring in, where we collect old athletic shoes from around the country, and we grind them up and make them into a superb sports surface. And we've used it indoors, we've used it outdoors. The Australian Open tennis courts are all Nike Regrind. Rucker Park in New York City, the famous basketball courts are Nike Regrind. We lay down about 12 to 15 of these surfaces a year, and we have soccer fields, we have, if you've been out to the Nike campus, the Tiger Woods tee at the to the right of Lance Armstrong is Nike Regrind, and the entire Bo Jackson football field is Nike Go Regrind. So or Nike Regrind. So there's actually a lot of different uses for it, and it was a wonderful way to resurface these courts because it's very tolerant to weather, it's very forgiving, it's a little softer than asphalt, and it holds up like that. So that was one of the first things we did in terms of thinking about how to get kids active and then give them the means to do it by making sure there's safe, accessible facilities. We've also been committing over 52,000 hours of volunteer time in and around the city of Portland and Beaverton, working on projects like restriping basketball and baseball fields, painting structures and parks, and then working in the schools. We've actually launched what we're calling the Nike Go Fund program, where we either have entire departments that will go in teams and work as recess buddies, helping kids that are kind of on the side of the playground that aren't really being included play some kind of activity, making sure the kids are playing in a safe way, making sure that all the little spats that go on in a school that has 500 kids out at recess, you know, preventing some of those. And then also figuring out what can we do before school in terms of these walking school buses and these safe routes to school programs and so forth. We really want to drive. We've actually, the president of the U.S. region, Gary DeStefano, has challenged the employee base in Portland and Beaverton to double that 52,000 this year. That was last year's number. So we're shooting for 100,000 hours. We've actually hit 54,000 already, and all of the increase is supposed to be Nike Go, get kids moving kinds of hours. So we're pretty hopeful. In addition, every time an employee commits an hour to this program, we commit $10 to the organization with whom they're working and $10 to a fund that will help pay for these court refurbishments. So we're putting a lot of energy, time, thinking, and money behind that part of the program. We've recently put made available two $50,000 challenge grants to support the PIL push to save spring athletics, after-school athletics in the Portland School District. And we've offered some major support to the students' walk that's occurring this Saturday in terms of T-shirts, screening, advertising, public release, public relations releases, and so forth to make sure that we get people out and walking to help save that program this spring. That's kind of an overview of what we're just doing in the backyard right now. The thing that we know about active youth, and this is something we've known for decades because we've had different iterations of Go over time, the If You Let Me Play campaign, the Play Foundation, and so forth, is that when kids are active, they're much more self-confident. They're much less likely to suffer from depression. They're much less likely to have unwanted pregnancies, particularly if they're female. They're 60% less likely to get breast cancer again.
Okay.
Although I have to say that my boss at the Gap, who was Don Fisher, did have breast cancer. Mm-hmm. And they're far more successful in school. So we know that the outcomes for these kids, in addition to being slimmer and fitter socially, are pretty profound over the short and long term. So it's something we feel particularly strongly about. We'll know we're successful when we've joined with partners across Oregon in the governmental sector, in the private sector, in the nonprofit sector, and figured out what that roadmap is and what our niche is to make sure that kids across Oregon are happier, healthier, and they're performing over the long term. So that's kind of the goal of Nike Go. That's what we hope to do over time. And, you know, any support that we can provide in terms of encouragement or positioning around policies that could drive more physically active, less sedentary kids, we would be in favor of doing. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay, questions?
Yes.
Yes, Senator Walker.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I really enjoyed the presentation and the commitment that Nike's making, especially to the University of Oregon, my alma mater, and where I live. I find it really fascinating because I mentioned this the other day in committee. I won the President's Physical Fitness Award in the sixth grade. Mm-hmm. I was never so proud of something that I had worked really hard because I had to run this race like five times that day to meet the time requirement. And I was going through some stuff in the garage this weekend, putting it away after we done some shuffling around, and I found my badge, a little sew-on badge in my award that was signed by President Johnson. So that is exactly what this program can do for kids, because it makes them think about things and feel good about themselves, and I really want to commend you on that. I also have to ask you, this Nike Go theme, it's just running in my head. There's a commercial running on TV with this naked guy who runs out into some tournament. Is that the Nike Go theme?
Senator Walker.
It's fabulous
that
commercial.
That has just been a big attention getter for us.
I'm sure.
It is actually not a Nike Go ad. That was an ad that we ran. It was actually a shoe ad. You would never know that from watching this hilarious naked man run around on a soccer field, but it was actually a shoe ad. And it did get, I think, you know, in terms of elevating the brand and making people pay attention, yeah, everybody was talking about that ad, but it wasn't. It was not to promote Nike Go.
I was hoping not, but I've been out in the kitchen cooking before, and my husband was, you've got to come see this ad, and it really is hysterical.
Yeah.
Good advertising. Well, maybe you can come up with something that's good for kids.
That, and see, I think that's really the point, is when, and that's the question we're asking ourselves right now. There's a communications component to Nike Go. The question we're asking ourselves is, because you can put a brand like Nike on an issue and you can skew it. You can actually take the thing off track and it can become more about the company than it is about the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And the question we're asking ourselves is, when do we start to really launch the kind of if you let me play kinds of marketing programs and public relations programs and other kinds of communication programs that can really drive this issue as opposed to talk about Nike? Because I think we have to be cognizant of the fact that there have been times when we've stepped in on an issue when all of a sudden it was about Nike, and it took some of the daylight off of that issue.
Right.
So one of the first things we're doing, the strategy is really to get some programs on the ground, to get some best practices in place, to find out what really works. We're actually launching a big program as a best practice pilot for the Native American lands coming starting in June, to target 10 reservations reservations around the country and put Nike Go programs on those reservations to try to dial back some of the types of diabetes showing up in Native American youth. And then should those be successful, we'll broaden them to all reservation lands. And there's been conversations from the diabetes folks at the federal government to take it beyond that to kids in the broader community. So we're very cognizant of the fact that there's some opportunity here to really put programs in place that will start getting kids moving and at least hopefully begin some of these lifestyle shifts. And we want to make sure those are in place before we start talking about it, whether it's talking about what we're doing or talking about what our partners are doing. But at some point, the fun part is going to be, what's the streaker ad for Nike Go?
And just to follow up, there's a young woman in my community, Claire Rosenfeld, who was the first youth ambassador for diabetes. And she's received numerous awards, and she would be very, extremely happy to be working with you on this issue.
Okay.
So if you get in touch with my office, I'll get you the information.
Okay.
Senator Minnis.
One question. What have you done for PSU, my alma mater? You don't have to answer. I'm just kidding.
You got Nike Regrind.
It's interesting and it's fascinating, and I guess I have some assumptions about why Nike, and I applaud your stewardship in going after this particular targeted group. And you know, I'm assuming that there's some underlying thought that goes into attracting youth into athletics. Clearly, marketing and the products that Nike provides are an important part of that. But tell me, does Nike have any ongoing understanding of what this does in terms of lifelong athletic activity, in terms of lifelong health issues? And I'm almost thinking it would be funny to see a Nike ad with a grandmother on it with some Nike tennis shoes, because there's a whole demographic group of individuals who, and I'm getting close to this, you get to the age of 55, you're assumed to be a senior, and therefore you're incapable of accomplishing anything athletic.
Mm-hmm.
That underlying assumption in our culture, I think, is blatantly false. And I think when we have law, you know, Oregon is known for physician-assisted suicide and other kind of concepts that I abhor. But the underlying thought there is that once you get to a certain age, somehow your inherent value as a human being is no longer there. So, I mean, can you talk to me about the other side of the equation, or do we just focusing on kids.
Chairman Morris at Center Minutes. Well, obviously, we're particularly focused on youth because we think that's where the brand plays the best. And when we did the whole kind of where's the intersection of our resources and a community need that really could use our resources, it was specifically with youth because the brand is targeted to a 15-year-old boy. And it has less appeal with a 56-year-old whomever, unless they're a runner, or unless they're a basketball player, or unless they're really dialed into kind of youth culture. So I think it makes sense for Nike Go to start there. And I think the opportunity for us is, since we can't do it all, to figure out where we can start to create lifestyle shifts that will extend over the long term and try to dial back some of the really nasty trends we're seeing with the youth pop. I mean, it's appalling in the state of Oregon that we're approaching one out of every two kids is overweight. Now, that is a truly staggering statistic. And you know, flipping through the map of the United States and watching all those colors come up is a really, really grim foreboding kind of a indication of where we're going. So I think it's important for somebody to step in and say, look, we have got to try to stop this epidemic, and we need to try to change the way kids think about themselves. So does Nike think about sort of the mature population and making sure that there's access? You know, I would say we probably leave no stone unturned when it comes to people that want to go running or play basketball, particularly if they want to wear Nike shoes to do it. But in terms of where we're going to dedicate, obviously not limitless community resources, we're going to definitely target.
Okay. Now, you need to go back and talk to Alberto Salazar.
My neighbor.
Your neighbor. About what used to be the Nike Marathon, which I ran one time. And I was very happy when I passed the 78-year-old Mavis Lungberg, who ran that thing for years and years. But that was the last time they put it on in the Eugene area, which is unfortunate. They stopped doing the Nike Marathon. And that certainly did appeal to people of all ages. There were a lot of elderly people who mm-hmm. were involved in that. But I think that there needs to be some appeal to all ages. And overall, I think you've done a wonderful job. And I think that you do provide the pizzazz, I think, that attracts people and to encourage change of lifestyle. So I'm very happy with what I hear you're doing.
Mr. Chair, and I guess it's a privilege of old age to start thinking back. And I take you back two generations to the early 1960s when President Kennedy got off on his physical fitness kick, and I was doing a pretty fair job of playing basketball and stuff during those days, and hauling 100-pound sacks of fertilizer and potatoes and stuff around the fields, and doing pretty well keeping up my end of the work bargain. Found out I was totally physically unfit because I couldn't do a dozen or so of these things up on the parallel bars and all this kind of stuff. But I sat here and looked at this, and two generations later, I may not be all that physically fit yet, but I still get around pretty good. And I just couldn't help think that it's too bad we don't have some Nike work shoes for these young kids. Instead of teaching them so much to play all their life and go through life as a playboy, so to speak, if we could get them an idea of doing some physical exercise with work and things that might stand them in better stead than just getting the idea that everything's all play. And I probably not quite as popular of an idea, especially not with the younger generation. But
Chairman Morse, Senator Fisher, I think it's a good point. You have to reach them wherever they are. And not all of them are going to be active every day after school. Not all of them are going to wear Nike tennis shoes, which obviously is not the objective anyway. What we want to make sure is that there are programs for those kids, whether it's simply walking to school every day, whether they are willing to do a hip-hop parade class like the one we have in Portland, or the recycle bicycle where you scavenge old bicycles, refurbish them, and have a cycling club. Whatever it is that's going to work for them. And then figuring out what it is through the kids' business in terms of the array of products, which is something we will also do using Nike Go as a driver, that we can make available, whether they're PE products or just active life products for these kids that will make it possible for them, you know, to stay more active. And we're looking at things like nifty stuff you can put in the shoe that will tell them how far they've gone, or just something that makes them more motivated to keep moving. But we do have a whole active life line at Nike that is targeted to people who aren't necessarily going to run out on Rucker Park and start shooting hoops, but who want to be in the kind of clothing that will allow them to move actively throughout the day.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
How about weight scales for guys like me so I can tell if I'm losing weight when I'm doing this?
Nike scales. Great.
I'll check into equipment on that.
So every day when he looks down at his feet, he's going to see that Nike symbol. Got to go do something. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate your testimony.
Take time.
Okay. Mel?
We have one more speaker, okay. If I may.
Yes, Dr. Minor.
I'd like to introduce Dr. Minor Cleveland to tell you a little bit about our state plan development and the kickoff conference that we had on Tuesday.
Okay, good.
You all should have, I believe, a copy of the plan and the kind of pick books. But,
Dr. Cleveland, welcome.
Another center of the committee. It's a real pleasure to be here. My name is Minot Cleveland. I'm an internal medicine physician in Portland. I live in Milwaukee in the North Classical School District, where I have two kids, at Putnam High School. And I'm also a state chair of the Oregon Coalition for Promoting Physical Activity, which is a voluntary group of individuals and organizations that have worked in partnership with the public health community to create the statewide physical activity plan. If you would have been able to break away from your work down here on Tuesday and come up to our conference in Portland, as a few legislators were able to do, but it was very tough to do, you would have heard three things from me as I introduced these plans. I called my talk Pathways to an Oregon Vision, and I truly believe that that's what these statewide plans are. My first point is that these are really treasures. These are strategic plans that will lead to a different Oregon that is much healthier and much more active. Second point was that the process, the coming together of the groups and individuals that wrote these plans, will be the same process that will lead to their implementation. There's a good, strong track record of public health plans in diabetes and tobacco in this state being written and then implemented, and I'm confident that these partnerships that we have built, which I will say a word about, will lead to the implementation of these plans. And third, that anybody who either helped write these plans or become engaged in their implementation will really be playing an important part in the transformation of Oregon and the lives of Oregon. Why are these plans so valuable? I will say that, first of all, there are some of the first such plans, statewide public health comprehensive approaches to physical activity and healthy eating in the country. There's maybe one or two other states in the country that have done anything like this. I think it's fair to say that when Dr. Bill Dietz, who is from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, one of the top people in CDC, he heads up a section called the Division of Nutrition and Physical Activity. He was our keynote speaker at the conference. I believe that he heard enough about what's going on in Oregon in terms of the creation of these plans and the quality of these plans that he left feeling that Oregon is pretty far ahead of the curve in this work. Probably Dr. Cohn or Dr. Moore could confirm that if they had conversations with Dr. Dietz. But I do believe that he left knowing that we are moving forward in these areas in Oregon. And that is very exciting. In the plans, the copies that you were provided, I hope there's an insert showing some of the, for the respective plans, some of the partners that have already endorsed these plans. And if you look at that, I mean, I'll mention a couple. African American Health Coalition, American Cancer Society, the Heart Association, which is not on here, has also endorsed these plans and helped write them. Arthritis Foundation, physical education organizations, the Nutrition Council of Oregon that wrote the nutrition plan. Oregon Academy of Family Physicians. I mean, the list goes on, and there are people who have contributed to putting the plan together that are not just not on the endorsement list, but will be endorsing it. And what it shows is a broad coalition of community groups, public health groups, and a partnership that is very strong. In a sense, it's represented here today. Dr. Cohen, Dr. Moore from the public health community, myself as a chair of a voluntary group of organizations that represent the community organizations and various advocacy groups, and now delighted to see Nike being here again, potentially more and more as a corporate partner. I think some of the comments and questions that have already been asked address some of the many things that these plans address, including healthcare costs and the skyrocketing healthcare premiums that that employers are paying now, and that really is now the time to get serious about prevention and health promotion. And these plans provide opportunities for everyone to get on board on these issues, which are clearly bipartisan issues. So we need people from public health. We need people from the private sector. We need policymakers to become familiar with these plans and see how public policy and funding can best support at least parts of these plans as we begin to implement them. I guess I would urge the centers on the committee to consider two things regarding these plans. One is a general comment, and that is, again, we have plenty of copies. If other folks that you know want copies of these, we can get them to you. To become familiar with the plans, I know they're a few pages long, but it's good reading, and it's you will see that these are really high-quality strategic plans for improving physical activity and nutrition. And to see how public policy efforts that you all can play a key role in could begin to help implement parts of these plans. That's kind of my general encouragement. My second would be this, related to a more specific public policy issue that is addressed in the plans, in the physical activity plan. The first goal of the physical activity plan is about increasing daily physical activity among youth. And the second specific objective there is to increase the percentage of school-age youth who participate in quality daily physical education. Myself and others have been long advocates for quality PE in the schools and have tried to fight cuts and made efforts to improve the quality of PE. One of the specific strategies, Strategy B, is related to maintaining and implementing a bill that I'm sure Senator Morissette remembers, House Bill 3307 from the 99 legislature, which elevated the status of physical education to Tier 2 in the SIM process, meaning that the bill called for the statewide creation of statewide standards in PE, but local testing or assessment would occur at the district level, so there was total local control in terms of assessment. I just wanted to let you know kind of the status of this bill, which continues to be implemented, and how it's made a difference. There were really three provisions. First was that the bill called for an evaluation of the training that people who were teaching PE got, whether they were PE teachers or classroom teachers. And that was done. It was clear that, in general, those with more training did a better job, and that a lot of classroom teachers could use more training. And I'm so excited to hear this aspect of the Nike Go program that may be able to leverage some opportunities to improve training of those who teach physical education. Second, the bill called for creation of statewide standards by school year 2001-2002. A group of PE specialists, along with Margaret Bates, whose position was created at the Oregon Department of Education, did that. They did an excellent job and on time implemented, approved by the State Board of Education, school year 2001-2002, these statewide standards in PE. The third piece of the legislation was that by school year 2003-2004, each local district will have in place an assessment piece in physical education. I can tell you that a number of schools have already move forward to create an assessment piece. However that is done, however they decide they want to do it at the district level. There are districts that have done nothing. There are some way in between. The process of even going through the, at the district level, coming up with some assessment tool to figure out if kids in their district are meeting the statewide standards is a good process in itself, because it gets people thinking about how do we want to assess the quality of our PE instruction. Do we want a written knowledge test? Do we want a health-related fitness type of test? Do we want to just measure participation and that be enough to pass the sim? So it stimulates thought and discussion, and a lot of districts have done it, and it's very good to see. So the bill has had incredible impact and will continue to have impact. I do want to let you know a concern, which I am only just beginning to learn about, but there's, I know that a hot issue is the whole question of the sim and whether to keep it or not or to adjust it. And there's strong arguments to be made all around the table, I'm sure. I would just make a plea for you to consider to be aware of this, is that I understand that there is at least one version of a bill or at least one way of thinking, which would be, let's preserve sim testing for only math, science, reading, sort of matching those things that are in the No Child Left Behind federal legislation, and to drop the tier two status for things like physical education, arts and second language. I would urge you to think carefully before getting rid of that provision, because the physical education bill and that local assessment piece is an important part of continuing to improve the quality of physical education in this state, something that is, again, emphasized in this plan. And I think that to throw out that provision would be going in the wrong direction in terms of physical education and in terms of the problems we've heard about today. So I would urge you, as those discussions go on, and again, I don't know any of the specifics about bills, but to consider that if you drop that tier two status for PE, I believe Oregon kids will lose out in terms of quality physical education. I will conclude by saying that I'm very excited with what's happening now, like never before. I'm sitting here listening first to Dr. Cohn and then to Molly from Nike, and thinking about how far we've come in the last year or two with these plans and now these partnerships. And I am confident that we will continue to move down along a pathway that will lead to a transformation of Oregon. And I, as a big fan of sort of aphorisms and sayings, I appreciate Senator Walker's notion of the little prompts or new factoids or little sayings that could be changed, because that the prompting for stairwells do work, though after a while people quit seeing it. So if they know there's something new coming, I think they'll be taking the stairs. So I hope your stairwell committee goes well.
I'm going to find a counterpart on the House side.
Well, there you go. Again, it's showing that the stairwells are clearly a bipartisan issue.
That's right.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Doctor. Now you're going to answer the question about obesity and hunger, right?
Yes. I will say a word or two about that.
Oh.
I don't know if I can answer this question. I think it's a very interesting one. But I would say that, when you don't know where your next meal is coming from, you will eat whatever you can get your hands on, and as much of it as you can get your hands on. And I think that that food insecurity piece probably plays an important role here. So I don't have data to support that linkage, but it makes a great deal of sense to me. If we can work on that food insecurity piece, which there are a whole variety of reasons to work on it for, but this is yet another one that I think it does contribute to the problem of obesity that we have.
Thank you for those comments.
Just in closing, I guess I'd like to say that policy is a really effective tool. We know that from the tobacco arena, and I think the same is true here. One thing I would urge you to do, as the example of the CDC stairwell experiment proves, is to make sure that when you implement some kinds of policy changes, that there is an evaluation component in there, because we really need to learn what works. We can't afford to wait until everything's been tested and proven before we start doing something. But as we do it, we need to evaluate it and make sure that we're learning from it as much as we can. So with that, I'm going to close my remarks. I think I really appreciate the opportunity to come and talk with you today, and If there are any other questions now, I'll be happy to take them, or in the future, please feel free to contact.
I do have a couple of questions. With respect to this material, what's the strategy for disseminating the information? I know in government we oftentimes create really nifty little packets like this, but then we kind of fall short of how do we get it out to the public and actually do something with it.
That's a great question, Senator Minnis, and I think that if as you go through the plan, you'll see that this is a comprehensive approach, so there's a variety of ways that people see opportunities to do that, including creating media campaigns, working in partnership with private sector, other organizations, particularly around specific community events, like the Walk to School Day event, which our coalition and a number of other folks were involved in, is a great way to kind of get the message out about physical activity and health and the safety of communities. So using community events, trying to get health systems involved in sponsoring community events such as that, and also figuring out ways to do media campaigns to kind of give a consistent message about the value of being active and healthy nutrition. And I think I think when we start talking about that, that's again another potential for partnership with the private sector, Nike and whomever can participate, because they tend to have much more expertise about how to get a message out than a lot of us who are whether physicians or in the public sector. So I think there are a number of specific ways that we can do that so that the message really gets out.
All right.
I guess there's one add on to maybe something what Senator Fisher said earlier, and that's the difference, the cardiovascular exercise, which running does. It does give you that cardiovascular, and I've never been into weight training. I always thought that was kind of dumb. I didn't want big muscles. I wanted
to.
So the cardiovascular is, I think, what Nike is all about, isn't it, basically?
The Nike Health Program?
Yeah.
Shannon wants that. It really is. It is not. I mean, we're not going to be using calipers to test kids' waistlines. We're not going to be weighing them. We're not going to be tracking that kind of medical data.
Yeah.
What we really want to do, we're really tying it to two things. The first is, can we get these kids?
Can you move toward the front, please?
Sorry.
Because you are on.
I'm perched in the back.
And you're on live Oregon-wide television right now.
The first is, we want to make sure that kids, that we can get kids to approach some kind of daily average and weekly average that's tied to the CDC and the state recommendations. So half an hour a day, an hour a day. We'd like to see if we can build and implement programs, whether in school or after school or summer, that get kids moving for those required periods of time per day in some kind of physical activity, whether they're walking, they're running, they're playing, they're vacuuming, whatever it is they're doing. And then over time, what we'd like to track and what we will evaluate is, are we getting self-identified shifts in the way these kids think about themselves? And if we can start to take kids, I've visited every one of the launches of all 15 of the, we actually have 16 live programs. I've visited 15 of those launches. And to talk to kids from Honolulu, that was a tough launch, Hawaii, and to talk to kids in a Boys and Girls Club there, one girl was on the large side, and she was a reader. And she loved to read, and she would go to the Boys and Girls Club after school, and she would read. And there wasn't a program by the time she had hit her age, which was about 9, where she felt comfortable and successful and like she was having fun in any of the athletic activities they had going on. When they started the program we funded, which was a brand new $15,000 outrigger canoe, and they started a culturally based canoe program, she thought, I can paddle. That's something I can do. And she got in the canoe, and she paddles every day, and they have a whole full-blown program that includes hiking and everything else. And she now self-identifies as an active person. She's gone from being a reader to somebody who has an active component in her life. If we can build those kinds of behavior and self-perception shifts into these kids and help carry them out to adulthood, it will be a huge home run for us. So the cardiovascular thing we're tying more to, are they doing something active every day for a stipulated amount of time or close to it? And then over the long term, are we getting these kinds of shifts that we're really hoping will drive long-term behavior?
Senator Morissette, if I might also briefly respond, I would just mention the you know, our plan is called the Statewide Physical Activity Plan. It's not the Statewide Exercise Plan or the Statewide Sports Program Plan. It's the focus now in kind of public health and in terms of the benefits of activity are really focused on physical activity as a broad category. Then we have exercise and aerobic exercise as one way to get that physical activity. You can have sports. You can have, you know, walking to school or walking to work or hiking, incorporating physical activity in just your taking care of your errands. So the broad category of physical activity is kind of what we're in the plan we're focused about, so that there are many different ways to get there. And what I heard when we were out at Nike on Tuesday evening at the reception was that the GO program, again, was not primarily focused on sports or just everybody playing basketball. It's focused on getting kids active in a way that works for them in their communities that's culturally appropriate. And so, I mean, various dancing, hip-hop stuff, you know, I'm pretty good still at basketball, and I still play run up and down. Not very good at hip-hop. But that's what these kids in their environment they did. So that's exciting that it's focused on this big category of physical activity, not just sports or not even just aerobic exercise. It's like if they move and we get that 30 minutes of activity, then all you have to be aerobic exercise. We get 30 minutes of activity a day, then we get most all the health benefits.
And if I just add a comment, I think two things. One, if they don't think about it as physical activity and something they got to build into their day, like the five a day, we're going to be better off. Oh my gosh, I really want to go out and do my Irish dance class or whatever it is. I think it's interesting anecdotally to look at the 16 programs that we launched as a pilot with kids. And we didn't get a basketball program. We didn't get a football program. We didn't get the standard traditional sports programs that you might think of as kind of Nike athletic areas. We got these very fringy. We got one club suggesting that they do an around-the-world dance program where they do dances from cultures around the world. We got an African step dance in Chicago that is the most aerobic thing I have ever laid my eyes on. I've never seen. You can't see all the stuff these kids are doing, but it's so powerful and it's so seductive and it's so irresistible. You want to do it. Those are the kinds of programs that we think are the home runs. And I'm sure they're getting a wicked cardiovascular workout.
And they're probably doing it because it's fun, not because it's good for them.
They're doing it because they love it.
Good.
Yeah.
Just like it.
Yes.
Actually, that's one of the reasons I quit wrestling in high school. I did throughout my senior year, but it was interesting that in my junior year, it dawned on me at 5'6" tall, it didn't make any difference if I became an Olympic champion. After that, that was the end of my athletic career as far as any professional sport, so I pretty much got out of that. But I guess the question I have for you is whether or not we can demonstrate. I know Nike has, a fairly liberal policy about employees being active and engaging in athletic activity. Is there a correlation that Nike can demonstrate in terms of healthcare utilization and that particular policy?
Senator Minister Chairman Morrison.
That's a home run. That's a home run pitch, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, right. He would ask that. Because,
served it right up.
Dr. Dietz was out at the campus Monday night, and pretty much the first question he asked us off the bat. There's a program at Nike. There's a policy at the Nike camp. I don't know if you've been out. We'd love to have you come out and visit, and I hope you will take me up on that offer.
Great.
We'd love to give you a tour and take you to lunch or what have you. In any case, the campus is fraught, rife, covered with amenities. There are two huge sports facilities. There are 8 restaurants. There's a beauty salon. There's stores. You could live there. In fact, who knows? Maybe people do. But there are people that never go home. There's a policy at Nike that you have an hour and a half a day to get some physical activity and take a shower. We emphasize a half hour for the shower and then the personal hygiene thing. But we really emphasize the fact that we want everybody on that campus to be active. And there's tons of walking trails. There's a burned path all the way around, a 2-mile run. Running path that is specifically set up with bridges over the entrances so you don't have to stop and cross. The whole thing is laid out and set up for people to be active. And not very intuitively, as you would expect, it's a pretty darn fit population we got out there at Nike. You're not allowed to smoke on campus. You actually have to walk off campus. And it's a 175-acre campus, so depending on where you're standing, it could take you a while to walk for that cigarette.
you don't see a lot of smokers, and you don't see a lot of people that are completely sedentary, because you're just surrounded by messaging and products and brand appeal and facilities that, you know, that inspire you to be active. And Dr. Dietz's question was, is there any way that we could find out, do some kind of an evaluation to see whether the health costs associated with Nike employees are lower than health costs for other kinds of similar businesses headquartered in Oregon or elsewhere, due to the fact that we have these policies and people are more active? And I don't know what kind of data we already collect. I would say anecdotally, I mean, we've got a bunch of people at the Nike campus that can still run a sub-4 mile. I'm not one of them. I don't think I ever did. But there's a lot of people out there that are just incredibly active. So I suspect there's a way that we could track that. I don't know that we already do, but there's certainly interest from the CDC and perhaps from you all to see if there's a way we can make that correlation.
Well, one of the things that Senator Minnis mentioned at an earlier meeting is, you know, the self-insured programs. The city of Springfield does have self-insured workers' comp, and they do have fitness centers in each of their fire halls and at the police station and so on, and there definitely is a correlation. Mm-hmm. I mean, they say it pays off big time, because there are relatively few, you know, people calling in sick and so on. Mm-hmm.
In fact, that's where I get the question. Is that, yeah, the Portland Police Association, Portland's self-insured, and when our association looked at health care utilization for police officers compared to other city workers, they found that our utilization was much less. So their argument was, take us out of the larger pool, we'll self-insure our own people because we're more active and more willing to take care of ourselves. And so they, at least they're seeing a correlation, making those arguments in their union negotiations.
I think we all intuitively know that there's got to be a really strong correlation. And it may be that HR at Nike is already tracking that. I know that the benefits are certainly generous enough that they're obviously doing well on the health insurance fund. So
good. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll close the meeting.
Sure.
Jane.
No.
We're adjourned. I'm sorry. We just adjourned.
Oh.
But Jane, could I speak with you though?
They shut the television off. So.
I forgive me. We did adjourn the meeting, but I did want to talk. Were you waiting to?